ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। I'm very, very grateful for this opportunity. I want to thank you all for allowing me to discuss Srimad Bhagavatam with you. And I ask for the blessings of all of you that I may be able to say something meaningful and inspiring to you today. So please give me your blessings.
Translation. O my Lord, the all-pervading personality of Godhead, I offer my respectful obeisance unto you. But Vasudeva means to Krishna, the son of Vasudeva. Since by chanting the name of Krishna, Vasudeva, one can achieve all the good results of charity, austerity and penances. It is to be understood that by chanting of this mantra, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, the author or the speaker or any one of the readers of Srimad Bhagavatam is offering respectful obeisance unto the Supreme Lord Krishna, the reservoir of all pleasure. In the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the principles of creation are described, and thus the first canto may be called creation. In the second canto, the post-creation cosmic manifestation is described. The different planetary systems are described in the second canto as different parts of the universal body of the Lord. For this reason, the second canto may be called the cosmic manifestation. There are 10 chapters in the second canto. In these 10 chapters, the purpose of Srimad Bhagavatam and the different symptoms of this purpose are narrated. The first chapter describes the glories of chanting, and it hints at the process by which the neophyte devotees may perform meditation on the universal form of the Lord. In the first verse, Sukhdev Goswami replies to the question of Maharaj Parikshit, who asked him about one's duties at the point of death.
Maharaj Parikshit was glad to receive Sukadeva Goswami, and he was proud of being a descendant of Arjuna, the intimate friend of Krishna. Personally, he was very humble and meek, but he expressed his gladness that Lord Krishna was very kind to his grandfathers, the sons of Pandu, especially his own grandfather Arjuna. And because Lord Krishna was always pleased with Maharaj Parikshit's family, at the verge of Maharaj Parikshit's death, Sukadeva Goswami was sent to help him in the process of self-realization. Maharaj Parikshit was a devotee of Lord Krishna from his childhood, so he had natural affection for Krishna. Sukadeva Goswami could understand his devotion. Therefore, he welcomed the questions about the king's duty. Because the king hinted that worship of Lord Krishna is the ultimate function of every living entity, Sukadeva Goswami welcomed the suggestion and said, "Because you have raised questions about Krishna, your question is most glorious." The translation of the first verse is as follows.
So, just one notable thing to point out about this text. It describes the potency of Krishna Katha. Just by chanting this invocation mantra, the author or the speaker or any one of the readers is offering respectful obeisances to Lord Krishna and receiving purification by that process. It's just natural that anyone involved directly or indirectly within the process of Krishna Katha receives benefit. And that's why Sukadeva Goswami is actually just ecstatic to hear Maharaj Parikshit's question. If we look back at the end of the first canto, Parikshit is asking, what are one's duties at the time of death? What do we chant, hear, remember, worship? And he also mentions how he's very grateful to be a descendant of Krishna, of Arjuna, and that Krishna allowed him to take birth within that dynasty. And he specifically points out that Sukadeva must have been sent directly by Krishna, by Krishna's mercy, to Maharaj Parikshit in his final days. And we'll see this in the next text, how Sukadeva Goswami really appreciates how the question relates to Krishna, because he can see how Parikshit is interested in hearing Krishna Katha. So we'll go on to text one, translation and purport.
Sri Shukadev Goswami said, "My dear king, your question is glorious because it is very, very beneficial to all kinds of people. The answer to this question is the prime subject matter for hearing, and it is approved by all transcendentalists. Even the very question is so nice that it is the best subject matter for hearing. Simply by such questioning and hearing, one can achieve the highest perfectional stage of life. Because, Lord, Krishna is the original Supreme Person, any question about him is original and perfect. Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said that the highest perfection of life is to achieve the transcendental loving service of Krishna. Because questions and answers about Krishna elevate one to that transcendental position."
Mahaparikshit wanted to absorb his mind completely in Krishna, and such absorption can be effected simply by hearing about the uncommon activities of Krishna. For instance, in the Bhagavad Gita, it is stated that simply by understanding the transcendental nature of Lord Krishna's appearance, disappearance, and activities, one can immediately return home, back to Godhead, and never come back to this miserable condition of material existence. It is very auspicious, therefore, to hear always about Krishna. So Maharaj Pariksit requested Sukadeva Goswami to narrate the activities of Krishna so that he could engage his mind in Krishna.
The activities of Krishna are non-different from Krishna himself. As long as one is engaged in hearing such transcendental activities of Krishna, he remains aloof from the conditional life of material existence. The topics of Lord Krishna are so auspicious that they purify the speaker, the hearer, and the inquirer. They are compared to the Ganges waters, which flow from the toe of Lord Krishna.
Wherever the Ganges waters go, they purify the land and the person who bathes in them. Similarly, Krishna Gita, or the topics of Krishna, are so pure that wherever they are spoken, the place, the heart, the inquirer, the speaker, and all concerned become purified.
So it's important to notice in this text, Shukadeva Goswami is finally speaking to Pariksit, and the first thing he does is offer obeisances to Krishna, and then immediately after this, what is he doing here? He's glorifying the question that Maharaj Pariksit asked because it's relating to Krishna. And this is a very important part of the culture that we've come into, the Vedic culture, just in the society of Krishna consciousness. We see that this is a very important part of it, glorifying each other for wanting to pursue the path of Krishna consciousness. And when you think about it, you think about the effort. Just think personally about the effort you've put into this, and how, the things that you may have given up to come to this path. And it's not easy. It's not an easy way out necessarily. It's a difficult path. And so to see others coming to that path or wanting or being inspired to take up this path, you naturally, no matter what stage you're in, you have some kind of respect for someone who's willing to do that. And someone like Shukadeva Goswami, who's very, very elevated and knows all about the glories of Krishna and about the path of Krishna consciousness, is ecstatic to just see someone who is wanting to absorb his mind in Krishna Katha. Also, we get more into this topic of Krishna Katha and how purifying it is. When I read through this verse and purport, when it discusses the purifying effect of talking about Krishna, and it says, simply by understanding the transcendental nature of Lord Krishna's appearance, disappearance, and activities, one can immediately return home back to Godhead. Immediately return home back to Godhead and never come back to this miserable condition of material existence. So just by understanding Krishna, which involves, of course, hearing about him and serving his devotees. But this reminds me of a text from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Atha Shri Krishna Namadi Na Bhavid Grayam Indriyahi Sevan Mukhi Jiva Dao Swayam Eva Spratyadaha, that the material senses as they are within the human body simply can't perceive Krishna, can't perceive Krishna's form, his name, his qualities and pastimes. These are all transcendental. So it requires the rendering of service, starting with the tongue. Sevan Mukhi Jiva Dao, beginning with the tongue, to chant the Lord's holy names, to chant about topics of Krishna, and even tasting prasadam, starting with the tongue, just by rendering these services, these simple services, really, we actually come to be purified. And Swayam Eva Svaratyadaha, the Lord becomes manifest personally to someone who is engaging in this process of purification. We even see in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Chapter 2, Divinity and Divine Service. There's a nice string of texts here that describe this process of rendering service, becoming purified. Yeah, and with sword in hand, intelligent men cut through the binding knots of reactionary work, karma, by remembering the personality of Godhead. Therefore, who will not pay attention to his message? It goes on to say that by rendering service, to pure devotees, we actually gain the affinity for hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, for hearing about Krishna, just by starting with some sadhu sangha, some association with the devotees and rendering service to them. And then by this process, we want to hear. And by hearing, our hearts are cleansed. Krishna from within the heart cleanses the heart. And this is also in Bhagavad Gita, 10.10 and 10.11. Krishna says to those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, I give them the understanding by which they can come to me. And I, dwelling in their hearts, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. This is what's being described here in the first canto of Bhagavatam, that simply by rendering service, our hearts become purified. And as our hearts become purified, we come to the stage of goodness. By attaining the mode of unalloyed goodness, we can, at that point, actually receive some positive scientific knowledge of Krishna, which actually happens by a mystical process, really. And this whole process is going on. So you start by some service, then you develop some love for Krishna that just takes the influence of the lower modes away, and then you really start to gain this real knowledge. And that is the transcendental way of life, and this puts us completely aloof from conditional life. To reach that stage, you're no longer bound by the condition of material existence. So this is why Shukadev is so ecstatic to talk to Parikshit, and he's glorifying this question about Krishna because this is it. This is the highest. Just talking about Krishna, hearing about Krishna is supremely purifying and brings one to the highest state of self-realization, God-realization. It's the highest state of existence. So let's continue on to text 2 translation and purport, please.
Those persons who are materially engrossed, being blind to the knowledge of ultimate truth, have many subject matters for hearing in human society, O Emperor.
Purport. In the revealed scriptures, there are two nomenclatures for the householder's life. One is Grihastha and other is Grihamedhi. The Grihasthas are those who live together with wife and children, but live transcendently for realizing the ultimate truth. The Grihamedhis, however, are those who live only for the benefit of family members, extended or centralized, and thus they are envious of others. The word Medhi indicates jealousy of others. The Grihamedhis, being interested in family affairs, only are only are certainly envious of others. Therefore, one Grihamedi is not on good terms with another Grihamedi, and in the extended form, one community, society or nation is not on good terms with another counterpart of selfish interest. In the age of Kali, all the householders are jealous of one another because they are blind in the knowledge of ultimate truth.
They have many subject matters for hearing, political, scientific, social, economic and so on. But due to a poor fund of knowledge, they set aside the question of the ultimate miseries of life, namely miseries of birth, death, old age and disease. Factually, the human life is meant for making an ultimate solution to birth, death, old age and disease. But the Grihamedis, being illusioned by the material nature, forget everything about self-realization. The ultimate solution to the problems of life is to go back home, back to Godhead. And thus, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 8, verse 16, the miseries of material existence, birth, death, old age and disease are removed. The process of going back home, back to Godhead, is to hear about Supreme Lord and His name, form, attributes, pastimes, paraphernalia and variegatedness. Foolish people do not know this. They want to hear something about the name, form, etc. of everything temporary, and they do not know how to utilize this propensity of hearing for the ultimate good. Misguided as they are, they also create some false literature about the name, form, attribute, etc. of the ultimate truth. One should not therefore become a Grihamedi simply to exist for envying others. One should become a real householder in terms of the spiritual injunctions.
Everybody is engaged in katha. Some sort of katha is going on between everyone. And we see clearly pointed out here the difference in what's being discussed between real grihasthas who are following scriptural injunctions and Grihamedis who are simply looking for material enjoyment. So we see that the Grihamedis or you know, anyone who's just out for sense gratification, they all have things to discuss. They have katha, it's right here. They have many subject matters for hearing: political, scientific, social, economic, and so on. But what's the problem? What's the problem with these things that they're discussing? It's all temporary. There's no lasting meaning. Yes. It causes frustration, absolutely. Because where is it leading? What is it ultimately bringing? You're absorbing yourself in something temporary, and you're just you're wasting your time, really, if you're just engaging in discussing something temporary. And so, someone who is following scriptural injunctions understands the value of something transcendental and lasting, and engages in that kind of katha. It's also important to point out the difference. It's distinguished here between Grihastha and Grihamedi, and especially in the early days of the ISKCON movement, there were some offenses made by some brahmacharis who saw people moving into the Grihastha ashram and looked down on them for doing this, thinking that their sense enjoyers are the Grihamedis. But this is an offensive mentality, and it's important to distinguish between Grihastha and Grihamedi. Someone who is truly in the Grihastha ashram, pursuing Krishna consciousness, recognizes the problems of life, namely birth, death, old age, and disease, and is striving to overcome them, to create something lasting. And brahmacharis and grihasthas must work together in the society for the movement to propagate successfully. The Grihastha ashram may not appear as glorious as that of the renunciates who are very fast-paced and out preaching, but the Grihasthas are absolutely necessary and are glorifiable because they're like anchors. The path may be slow at that point, but it's steady, it's solid. And this is so necessary to keep the movement going, because the grihasthas provide for the temples, provide for the renunciates who are having to go out and propagate this mission. So it's like an army, and you have people who are in the support and people on the front lines. Everyone must work together.
The lifetime of such an envious householder is passed at night either in sleeping or in sex indulgence, and in the daytime either in making money or maintaining the family members. Purport. The present human civilization is primarily based on the principles of sleeping and sex indulgence at the night and earning money in the day and spending the same for family maintenance. Such a form of human civilization is condemned by the Bhagavad school.
Because human life is a combination of matter and spirit soul, the whole process of Vedic knowledge is directed at liberating the spirit soul from the contamination of matter. The knowledge connecting this is called Atma Tattva. Those men who are too materialistic are unaware of this knowledge and are more inclined to economic development for material enjoyment. Such materialistic men are called karmis, or fruitive laborers, and they are allowed regulative economic development and association of women for sex development or association of women for sex indulgence. Those who are above the karmis, that is, the jnanis, yogis, and devotees, are strictly prohibited from sex indulgence. The karmis are more or less devoid of Atma Tattva knowledge, and as such, their life is spent without spiritual profit. The human life is not meant for hard labor, for economic development, nor is it meant for sex indulgence like that of the dogs and hogs.
It is specially meant for making a solution to the problems of material life and the miseries thereof. So, the karmis waste their valuable human life by sleeping in sex indulgence at night and by laboring hard in the daytime to accumulate wealth. And after doing so, they try to improve the standard of material life. The materialistic way of life is described herein in a nutshell, and how foolishly men waste the boon of human life is described as follows.
All right, we're gonna go on to text 4. This is the highlighted verse of the day. 214. So we're gonna just chant the Sanskrit for this. I'll read it one line at a time, and you can repeat. Deha patchakalatra dishu.
Deha patchakalatra dishu.
Atmasanyeshu satsvapi.
Atmasanyeshu astupi.
Tesham pramato nidhanam.
Tesham pramato nidhanam.
Pashyanapi na pashyati.
Pashyanapi na pashyati.
Deha patya kala tradishu.
Deha patya kala tradishu.
Atmasanyeshu satsvapi.
Atmasanyeshu satsvapi.
Tesham pramato nidhanam.
Tesham pramato nidhanam.
Pashyanapi na pashyati.
Pashyanapi na pashyati.
Please chant. Deha patya kala tradishu.
Atma
sanyeshva satsvati. Isham pramato nidhanam.
Pashyanapi na pashyati.
Deha patya kala tradishu.
Atma sanyeshva satsvati.
Esham pramato nidhanam.
Pashyanapi na pashyati.
Deha patya kala tradishu. Deha patya kala tradishu.
Atma sanyeshva satsvati.
Atma sanyeshva satsvati.
Esham pramato.
Esham pramato nidhanam.
Pashyanapi na pashyati.
Pashyanapi na pashyati. Mothers, Matajis. Deha patya kala tradishu. Atma sanyeshva satsvati. Esham pramato nidhanam. Thank you.
Translation.
Persons devoid of atma-tattva do not inquire into the problems of life, being too attached to the fallible soldiers like the body, children, and wife. Although sufficiently experienced, they still do not see their inevitable destruction. Purport. The material world is called the world of death. Every living being, beginning from Brahma, whose duration of life is some thousands of millions of years, down to the germs who live for only a few seconds, is struggling with existence. Therefore, this life is a sort of fight with material nature, which imposes death upon all. In the human form of life, a living being is competent enough to come to an understanding of this great struggle for existence, but, being too attached to family members, society, country, and so forth, he wants to win over the invincible material nature by the aid of bodily strength, children, wives, relatives, and so forth.
Although he is sufficiently experienced in the matter by dint of past experience and previous examples of his deceased predecessors, he does not see that the fighting soldiers like the children, relatives, society members and countrymen are all fallible in the great struggle. One should examine the fact that his father or his father's father has already died and that he himself is therefore also sure to die. And similarly, his children, who are the would-be fathers of their children, will also die in due course. No one will survive in this struggle with material nature. The history of human society definitely proves it. Yet the foolish people still suggest that in the future, they will be able to live perpetually with the help of material science. The poor fund of knowledge exhibited by human society is certainly misleading, and it is all due to ignoring the constitution of the living soul. This material world exists only as a dream due to our attachment to it. Otherwise, the living soul is always different from the material nature. The great ocean of material nature is tossing with the waves of time, and the so-called living conditions are something like foaming bubbles which appear before us as bodily self, wife, children, society, countrymen, etc. Due to a lack of knowledge of self, we become victimized by the force of ignorance and thus spoil the valuable energy of human life in a vain search after permanent living.
Our friends, relatives, and so-called wives and children are not only fallible, but also bewildered by the outward glamour of material existence. As such, they cannot save us. Still, we think that we are safe. Within the orbit of family, society, or country. The whole materialistic advancement of human civilization is like the decoration of a dead body. Everyone is a dead body flapping only for a few days, and yet all the energy of human life is being wasted in the decoration of this dead body. Shukadev Goswami is pointing out the duty of the human being after showing the actual position of bewildered human activities. Persons who are devoid of the knowledge of Atma-tattva are misguided, but those who are devotees of the Lord and have perfect realization of transcendental knowledge are not bewildered.
Oh, Prabhupada. Jai Prabhupada. This purport is amazing. It's blunt, definitely blunt. It's like densely packed. It's poetic. It's just amazing. The great ocean of material nature is tossing with the waves of time, and the so-called living conditions are something like foaming bubbles, which appear before us as bodily self, wife, children, society, countrymen, etc. Due to a lack of knowledge of self, we become victimized by the force of ignorance, and thus spoil the valuable energy of human life in a vain search after permanent living conditions, which are impossible in this material world. So, material ocean is just tossing. And all these things that the people are attached to, they're like foaming bubbles, just insignificant, fleeting objects. And people devote so much time and energy in maintaining these attachments, pursuing these attachments. And it's implied here that people are seeking immortality. wasting valuable energy of human life in a vain search after permanent living conditions, which are impossible in this material world. Everything in this world, all this matter, is clearly temporary. But people are seeking immortality. When I first read this, I was thinking, are we really seeking immortality? Are people really after that specifically? It doesn't seem like most people are explicitly wanting or like saying, I'm going to live forever. I want to live forever. There is some talk of this by prolonging the life indefinitely through, you know, modern Kali Yuga technology, but it doesn't seem to be the aim for most people. But I meditated on it a little bit, and it boils down to not necessarily seeking immortality, but coping with what Prabhupada always referred to as this incompatible situation of being an eternal being within a body that's completely temporary. So by being in this world, naturally, inherently, there's this intrinsic fear that comes with being in this incompatible situation, a fear of losing those things which we enjoy, losing our attachments, losing the capacity to enjoy. We see that over time the body ages and we can't enjoy like we used to. That's the way it goes in human life. You lose your capacity to enjoy. And this is the greatest fear, because if we're in this material world to try to enjoy it, what's the worst thing that could happen? We stop enjoying. And our eternal nature is to enjoy with Krishna, to enjoy Krishna's association, to enjoy serving the servants of Krishna eternally. So to come to this temporary realm, we naturally have the fear of things vanishing before us. And we constantly see it play out right in front of us. The things that we're attached to vanish all the time. The things that we put so much effort into maintaining just disappear. So what's the struggle? What's the battle that we're fighting if we're seeking material enjoyment? You look at the sense enjoyers. What is the battle that they're fighting? They're fighting to cope. They're fighting to cope with this fear. Just trying to coexist with this incompatible situation and just to think it's okay. But it's explained in this purport. A living being, in the human form of life, a living being is competent enough to come to an understanding of this great struggle for existence. Of being too attached to family members, society, country, etc., he wants to win over the invincible material nature by the aid of bodily strength, children, wife, relatives, which is what the text is explaining. People devoid of atmatattva have these attachments, and they're sufficiently experienced. They see the temporary nature of this world, yet they don't acknowledge their inevitable destruction. Because it's simply too painful if you want to go on enjoying this world. So let's examine the fallible soldiers. What are the fallible soldiers explained here? Deha patyakalatradishu, the body, children, wife, and adishu, etc. All the things relating to these. They're employed as fallible soldiers. The living entity wants to win over the invincible material nature by the aid of these fallible soldiers. What does that mean?
That's right. In the form of friendship, family, and love. But there's no possibility of doing that.
Right.
So they're fallible soldiers. They're useless. Totally useless. Yeah. In terms of protecting us from the miseries of material existence. They cannot do the job.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's absolutely right. They're looking for protection, so they employ so many fallible soldiers that they think are going to keep them in a good permanent living condition. So what are they trying to protect themselves against? The miseries of life. You know, old age and disease, mostly. They want to try to prolong their enjoyment despite the onset of old age and disease. People don't want to die. They may acknowledge that it's going to happen. But despite the acknowledgement of death, they will have children that can carry on their legacy. They'll invest their time and energy into so many different fields so that they can somehow live on. But it's important to realize the temporary nature of these so-called fighting soldiers that are being employed in this battle.
Like we, as you said, these are the soldiers, but at the same time, we want to control these soldiers. I feel that these, like, especially children, every man wants to control their wife, children, and they want to have control over their everything.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is our complex. We all want to be the controller. We all want to be the enjoyer. But who's the enjoyer? Who's the controller? Krishna. Well. ultimately, in the absolute sense, who's the enjoyer? Krishna. And this is where Atma Tattva comes in. This is where Sambandha Gyan comes in. Who's familiar with the term Sambandha Gyan? Sambandha meaning relationship, Gyan meaning knowledge. Sambandha Gyan refers to having knowledge of our relationship with the material energy and with the controller of the material energy and the controller of us, Krishna. So we must have this understanding of this absolute relationship. And we must have this understanding of Atma Tattva, the knowledge of the self, the truth of the self as soul, in order to attain something real, something lasting, something absolute. I want to discuss kind of a final closing point, and that topic is sacrifice. I was recently asking myself, why am I in this movement? Why did I join this movement? Why do I stay in this movement? Why haven't I walked out of ISKCON's door yet? I just feel like it's an important question to ask. Why am I here? Why am I doing this? I'm not Krishna conscious yet, so I don't have Krishna conscious reasons. I don't have a deep love for Krishna that I've realized that I'm trying to pursue in this path. But I finally came to a conclusion about my reasons, and it refers to sacrifice. I had reflected upon something I heard from a devotee from Chaupati in India. His name is Jagannath Priya. I met him in New York. And I asked him for just some advice or some instruction, and he said, just remember that life, no matter what your position is, whether you're a brahmachari or a grihastha or a karmi, life is a sacrifice. It's a struggle. That's the nature of this existence. It involves sacrifice constantly. And I reflected on the past 20 years of my life. What was I doing? I was sacrificing so much time and energy in so many different places. And school, for instance, I've spent so many years, so much time doing that. And it was a great sacrifice. And I really came to understand that I knew it was unfulfilling in some sense because I didn't know where it was going. I didn't know where that was going. It didn't seem to lead to something really meaningful or lasting. It was a temporary thing that I was going after. So ultimately, What is the meaning of the sacrifice? And this ties in with fear. So what is the greatest fear? That everything that you're investing in, you're not gonna reap the returns from it. You're not going to get a good return on your investment. So why am I here? Because ISKCON provides a series of sacrifices, if you will, that allow for a transformation, a positive transformation in your action, in your mentality, ultimately in your consciousness. We're waking up early every day. We're chanting Hare Krishna every day, which is the ultimate beneficial sacrifice of this age, the Yuga Dharma, Sankirtan, chanting. We're hearing Srimad Bhagavatam every day. We're sitting through this class. You're tolerating me right now. You're sacrificing your time to endure this class that I'm giving. Thank you, by the way. By Krishna's grace, it's purifying and it's meaningful. It's lasting. So these are the sacrifices that we need to make. And we have the knowledge at this point of Atma Tattva. We understand at least theoretically about who we are, what our relation is to this world, what our relation is to Krishna. And so we understand there's a series of sacrifices that goes along to living up to that knowledge, to fulfilling that, to reaching a point where we've realized that knowledge. And that involves purification of the sacrifices that you perform. So everyone's fighting for something. Everyone's making some sacrifice. Everyone has their army, their soldiers, their tools to conquer. But what is everyone going for? People out there, just some are trying to enjoy. The Griha Medis, Medi refers to envy, that people are just envious of each other and trying to one-up one another. And that's what they're fighting for, and that's where their sacrifice goes. And in contrast, look at the glory of this movement, look at what we're trying to do. We're trying to use our time and energy to achieve transcendental life, aloof from the conditions, the binding ropes of the material nature. So we must continue with our battle against the false ego. Let me try to wrap up here with the quote from Bhagavatam at the end of the string of verses I was referring to earlier. Thus the knot in the heart is pierced and all misgivings are cut to pieces. The chain of fruitive actions is terminated when one sees the self as master. And this is the realization of Atma Tattva, realizing the self is the soul. It's transcendental to this material body we're inhabiting. And the knot in the heart is pierced. This knot, this being referred to here, is ahankara. This is false ego. It's what binds spirit to matter, which makes us identify with this material body, this material mind. So in order to pierce that knot, there's a series of sacrifices that begins with sadhu sangha and rendering service to devotees, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, and that's the beginning of the process that blossoms into this ongoing process of reviving our dormant transcendental Krishna consciousness. So we must fight on. Must fight on with the battle to achieve Krishna consciousness.
I used to sacrifice a lot of constructive activities in order to take intoxicants and just do all kinds of things like that. So I'm wondering, what are the... Even you're saying that everything... You kind of said that everything in life is a sacrifice, and so I'm wondering if you could specify a little bit more into as to whether there's some things that really are selfish that aren't such sacrifice, you know? Or just kind of give up?
Well, okay. I mean, even the selfish things that we go for involve some sort of sacrifice. Sometimes very, very heavy sacrifice. I mean, you referred to intoxication. And how that may be a very selfish thing to engage in, but it's not devoid of sacrifice. I mean, think about people who are addicted to drugs and think about some of the absurd sacrifices they make in order to feed that. People are doing crazy things. They're stealing, so many sacrifices are going on in that in order to uphold that kind of habit. And I mean, we see a lot of unorganized sacrifice for anyone who's trying to get some kind of sense gratification. Sacrifice isn't a selfless thing, and selfishness isn't devoid of sacrifice. How could you not say that Krishna consciousness is not a selfish thing? In a way it is. Like I said, why am I here? Because I want to transform my consciousness, and I feel like that's my best benefit. That's in my self-interest. I'm looking out for myself, really, by trying to pursue this path. Ultimately, I'd like to come to a point of selflessness and humility where I truly am just looking to serve, but it's still somewhat self-motivated. But the sacrifice has to be there. It's constantly there in order to achieve our goals. Even if our goals aren't so clear cut, there's still sacrifice. Does that help? Okay. Maybe we can talk later if you'd like to. Yeah.
I'll just simply comment. It was a very nice class, actually. And also that one of the things, I believe I read it in Narad Bhakti Sutra, but it was explaining that because Krishna is the self of all selves, that it's actually very appropriate to love ourselves.
To love ourselves.
To love ourselves and be interested in our self-interest, because Krishna is the self of all selves. That's what Narad says.
Okay.
What's that?
Yeah. I remember hearing, maybe it's in Bhagavatam, 10th canto, that only because Krishna loves us can we continue to love ourselves despite all the absurd things we might have done in the past. By Krishna's mercy and by his love for us, we can still love ourselves. And I see what you're saying, how it is important to love ourselves and because it's in relation to Krishna, because Krishna loves us. And yeah, thank you for that point. Yes, Mataji.
You made a pretty heavy statement that friends and family and these are all useless, I think you said. Are completely useless. And maintaining them is a completely useless effort. So I was just wondering, at what point do you think... at what point do you think those activities don't become useless? And is it a clear-cut line, or is there like a transition period?
Thanks for calling me out. It ultimately depends on your motive, on your consciousness. When I said that, I must have been referring to Grihamedis, people who are actually looking for something lasting within something temporary, material. And as text 4 is explaining, these things are all employed as fighting soldiers, but they're fallible. And they're employed in order for some people to enjoy the material world and to indirectly fight against these problems that we're facing. And at that point, it's kind of a useless endeavor because we're not actually gaining anything meaningful or lasting. We're keeping ourselves entangled in this world. So to purify that, you have to purify your sacrifice, purify your endeavor, your motive, purify your consciousness. And wherever you're sacrificing your time and energy ultimately determines your consciousness. So to do it for Krishna, to focus on raising a family, taking care of your wife or your husband and your children, for Krishna, this is not meaningless. It's absolutely meaningful. As far as it being a clear-cut line or a transition, I'm not entirely sure. I would think it's kind of a transitional process, because we're constantly progressing in transforming our consciousness. So it's Krishna doesn't see the act. He doesn't necessarily see the act we're performing. He sees the attitude we have behind what we're doing. He sees our consciousness. So by transforming our consciousness gradually, we gradually make the things that we're doing useful for Krishna. The more we're conscious of Krishna in our activities, in what we're maintaining, what we're sacrificing, the more it becomes something useful. If we're devoid of Atma Tattva, or devoid of Krishna consciousness, then it's clearly useless. I don't know if that's what you were looking for. Or...
Yeah, I think the Bhagavatam is condemning the idea of saying that my family is all I need. That's the point. That's the mentality. And the people who are pious or trying to be good people feel that way. Well, at least he's good to his family. Or at least the person's good to their family. So the Bhagavatam just saying that misses the point. I appreciate your answer. Doing it for Krishna is a whole different thing.
Yeah.
I have one question for you. What is it like for someone born and raised in Gainesville to live in Manhattan?
Oh man, I gotta say when Vala the Sane drove us into New York, and I got into, I think Brooklyn was the first place we arrived in. Oh my God, I was bewildered. It's ridiculous to see New York for the first time after coming from a more tame place, I guess. It's interesting the way it works there, because everyone seems to be in their own world, doing their own thing. It's very fast paced. Everyone's very busy walking around from here to there, doing something or other. But at the same time, there's this kind of collective individuality. So everyone's individually doing their own thing, but everyone just kind of accepts that that's what's going on. Not everyone's like a stereotypical rude New Yorker. People are not necessarily rude there. They kind of accept that everyone's doing their own thing. And it's cool, because we can go out on the streets in Doty and Corto, and people don't think it's weird. They just, because they're doing their own thing and they accept that we're doing our own thing. It's very cool, but it's nice to be back in Gainesville for some time. It kind of slows things down a little bit. The subtle body in New York is constantly attacked by sirens and loud people and just the hustle and bustle. It's very intense. So there's some relief in coming to somewhere that's a little more sattvic. But I've come to really appreciate the intense environment of New York, because it keeps you on guard, keeps you on your feet, which is important in Krishna consciousness.